Chapter 1. Tom Seeks New Adventures. Do you reckon Tom Sawyer was satisfied after all them adventures? I mean the adventures we had down the river, and the time we set the darky Jim free and Tom got shot in the leg. No, he wasn't. It only just bissoned him for more. That was all the effect it had. You see, when we three came back up the river in glory, as you may say, from that long travel, and the village received us with a torchlight procession and speeches, and everybody hurrahed and shouted, it made us heroes, and that was what Tom Sawyer had always been hankering to be. For a while he was satisfied. Everybody made much of him, and he tilted up his nose and stepped around the town as though he owned it. Some called him Tom Sawyer the Traveler, and that just swelled him up fit to bust. You see, he laid over me and Jim considerable, because we only went down the river on a raft and came back by the steamboat, but Tom went by the steamboat both ways. The boys envied me and Jim a good deal, but land, they just knuckled to the dirt before Tom. Well, I don't know, maybe he might have been satisfied if it hadn't been for old Nat Parsons, which was postmaster, and powerful long and slim, and kinda good-hearted and silly, and bald-headed, on account of his age, and about the talkiest old creature I ever see. For as much as 30 years he'd been the only man in the village that had a reputation, I mean a reputation for being a traveler, and of course he was mortal proud of it, and it was reckoned that in the course of that 30 years he had told about the journey over a million times and enjoyed it every time. And now comes along a boy not quite 15, and sets everybody admiring and gawking over his travels, and it just gave the poor old man the high strikes. It made him sick to listen to Tom, and to hear the people say my land. Did you ever? My goodness sakes alive. And all such things, but he couldn't pull away from it, any more than a fly that's got its hind leg fast in the molasses. And always when Tom come to a rest, the poor old creature would chip in on his same old travels and work them for all they were worth, but they were pretty faded, and didn't go for much, and it was pitiful to see. And then Tom would take another innings, and then the old man again, and so on, for an hour and more, each trying to beat out the other. You see, Parsons' travels happened like this. When he first got to be postmaster and was green in the business, there come a letter for somebody he didn't know, and there wasn't any such person in the village. Well, he didn't know what to do, nor how to act, and there the letter stayed and stayed, week in and week out, till the bare sight of it gave him a conniption. The postage wasn't paid on it, and that was another thing to worry about. There wasn't any way to collect that 10 cents, and he reckoned the government would hold him responsible for it and maybe turn him out besides, when they found he hadn't collected it. Well, at last he couldn't stand it any longer. He couldn't sleep nights, he couldn't eat, he was thinned down to a shatter, yet he doesn't ask anybody's advice, for the very person he asked for advice might go back on him and let the government know about the letter. He had the letter buried under the floor, but that did no good. If he happened to see a person standing over the place, it'd give him the cold shivers, and loaded him up with suspicions, and he would sit up that night till the town was still and dark, and then he would sneak there and get it out and bury it in another place. Of course, people got to avoiding him and shaking their heads and whispering, because, the way he was looking and acting, they judged he had killed somebody or done something terrible, they didn't know what, and if he had been a stranger they would have lynched him. Well, as I was saying, it got so he couldn't stand it any longer, so he made up his mind to pull out for Washington, and just go to the President of the United States and make a clean breast of the whole thing, not keeping back an atom, and then fetch the letter out and lay it before the whole government, and say, now, there she is, do with me what you're a mind to, though as heaven is my judge I am an innocent man and not deserving of the full penalties of the law, and leaving behind me a family that must starve and yet hadn't had a thing to do with it, which is the whole truth and I can swear to it. So he did it. He had a little wee bit of steamboating, and some stagecoaching, but all the rest of the way was horseback, and it took him 3 weeks to get to Washington. He saw lots of land and lots of villages and 4 cities. He was gone most 8 weeks, and there never was such a proud man in the village as he when he got back. His travels made him the greatest man in all that region, and the most talked about, and people come from as much as 30 miles back in the country, and from over in the Illinois bottoms, too, just to look at him, and there they'd stand and gawk, and he'd gabble. You never see anything like it. Well, there wasn't any way now to settle which was the greatest traveler. Some said it was Nat, some said it was Tom. Everybody allowed that Nat had seen the most longitude. But they had to give in that whatever Tom was short in longitude he had made up in latitude and climate. It was about a standoff, so both of them had to whoop up their dangerous adventures, and try to get ahead that way. That bullet wound in Tom's leg was a tough thing for Nat Parsons to buck against, but he bucked the best he could, and at a disadvantage, too, for Tom didn't set still as he'd orter done, to be fair, but always got up and sauntered around and worked his limp while Nat was painting up the adventure that he had in Washington, for Tom never let go that limp when his leg got well, but practiced it nights at home, and kept it good as new right along. Nat's adventure was like this. I don't know how true it is, maybe he got it out of a paper, or somewhere, but I will say this for him, that he did know how to tell it. He could make anybody's flesh crawl, and he'd turn pale and hold his breath when he told it, and sometimes women and girls got so faint they couldn't stick it out. Well, it was this way, as near as I can remember. He come eloping into Washington, and put up his horse and shoved out to the president's house with his letter, and they told him the president was up to the Capitol, and just going to start for Philadelphia, not a minute to lose if he wanted to catch him. Nat most dropped, it made him so sick. His horse was put up, and he didn't know what to do. But just then along comes a darky driving an old ramshackly hack, and he see his chance. He rushes out and shouts, "A half a dollar if you get me to the Capitol in half an hour, and a quarter extra if you do it in 20 minutes. "Done," says the darky. Natty jumped in and slammed the door, and away they went, a ripping and a tearing over the roughest road a body ever see, and the racket of it was something awful. Nat passed his arms through the loops and hung on for life and death, but pretty soon the hack hit a rock and flew up in the air, and the bottom fell out, and when it come down Nat's feet was on the ground, and he see he was in the most desperate danger if he couldn't keep up with the hack. He was horrible scared, but he laid into his work for all he was worth, and hung tight to the arm loops and made his legs fairly fly. He yelled and shouted to the driver to stop, and so did the crowds along the street, for they could see his legs spinning along under the coach, and his head and shoulders bobbing inside through the windows, and he was in awful danger, but the more they all shouted the more the nigger whooped and yelled and lashed the horses and shouted, "Don't you fret, I's gwine to get you die in time, boss, I's gwine to do it, show." For you see he thought they were all hurrying him up, and, of course, he couldn't hear anything for the racket he was making. And so they went ripping along, and everybody just petrified to see it, and when they got to the Capitol at last it was the quickest trip that ever was made, and everybody said so. The horses laid down, and Nat dropped, all tuckered out, and he was all dust and rags and barefooted, but he was in time and just in time, and caught the president and give him the letter, and everything was all right, and the president give him a free pardon on the spot, and Nat give the nigger 2 extra quarters instead of 1, because he could see that if he hadn't had the hack he wouldn't have got there in time, nor anywhere near it. It was a powerful good adventure, and Tom Sawyer had to work his bullet wound mighty lively to hold his own against it. Well, by and by Tom's glory got to paling down gradually, on account of other things turning up for the people to talk about, first a horse race, and on top of that a house afire, and on top of that the circus, and on top of that the eclipse, and that started a revival, same as it always does, and by that time there wasn't any more talk about Tom, so to speak, and you never see a person so sick and disgusted. Pretty soon he got to worrying and fretting right along day in and day out, and when I asked him what was he in such a state about, he said it most broke his heart to think how time was slipping away, and him getting older and older, and no wars breaking out and no way of making a name for himself that he could see. Now that is the way boys is always thinking, but he was the first one I ever heard come out and say it. So then he set to work to get up a plan to make him celebrated, and pretty soon he struck it, and offered to take me and Jim in. Tom Sawyer was always free and generous that way. There's a plenty of boys that's mighty good and friendly when you've got a good thing, but when a good thing happens to come their way they don't say a word to you, and try to hog it all. That war never Tom Sawyer's way, I can say that for him. There's plenty of boys that will come hankering and groveling around you when you've got an apple and beg the core off of you, but when they've got one, and you beg for the core and remind them how you give them a core one time, they say thank you most to death, but there ain't a going to be no core. But I notice they always get come up with, all you got to do is to wait. Well, we went out in the woods on the hill, and Tom told us what it was. It was a crusade. "What's a crusade?" I says. He looked scornful, the way he's always done when he was ashamed of a person, and says, "Huck Finn, do you mean to tell me you don't know what a crusade is?" "No," says I don't. And I don't care to, nuther. I've lived till now and done without it, and had my health, too. But as soon as you tell me, I'll know, and that's soon enough. I don't see any use in finding out things and clogging up my head with them when I may never have any occasion to use them. There was Lance Williams, he learned how to talk Choctaw here till one come and dug his grave for him. Now, then, what's a crusade? But I can tell you one thing before you begin, if it's a patent right, there's no money in it. Bill Thompson he. "Patent right," says he. I never see such an idiot. Why, a crusade is a kind of war. I thought he must be losing his mind. But no, he was in real earnest, and went right on, perfectly calm. A crusade is a war to recover the Holy Land from the Paynim. Which Holy Land? Why, the Holy Land there ain't but one. What do we want of it? Why, can't you understand? It's in the hands of the Paynim, and it's our duty to take it away from them. How did we come to let them get hold of it? We didn't come to let them get hold of it. They always had it. Why, Tom, then it must belong to them, don't it? Why, of course it does. Who said it didn't? I studied over it, but couldn't seem to get at the right of it, no way. I says. It's too many for me, Tom Sawyer. If I had a farm and it was mine, and another person wanted it, would it be right for him too? Oh, shucks. You don't know enough to come in when it rains, Huck Finn. It ain't a farm, it's entirely different. You see, it's like this. They own the land, just the mere land, and that's all they do own, but it was our folks, our Jews and Christians, that made it holy, and so they haven't any business to be there defiling it. It's a shame, and we ought not to stand it a minute. We ought to march against them and take it away from them. Why, it does seem to me it's the most mixed up thing I ever see. Now, if I had a farm and another person. Don't I tell you it hasn't got anything to do with farming? Farming is business, just common low down business, that's all it is, it's all you can say for it, but this is higher, this is religious, and totally different. Religious to go and take the land away from people that owns it? Certainly, it's always been considered so. Jim, he shook his head, and says. Mars Tom, I reckon day's a mistake about it, summer's day most surely is. I's religious myself, and I knows plenty religious people, but I hain't run across none that acts like that. It made Tom hot, and he says. Well, it's enough to make a body sick, such mullet-headed ignorance. If either of you'd read anything about history, you'd know that Richard Coeur de Lune, and the Pope, and Godfrey de Bouillon, and lots more of the most noble-hearted and pious people in the world, hacked and hammered at the Paynims for more than 200 years trying to take their land away from them, and swam neck-deep in blood the whole time, and yet here's a couple of sap-headed country yahoos out in the backwoods of Missouri setting themselves up to know more about the rights and wrongs of it than they did. Talk about cheek. Well, of course, that put a more different light on it, and me and Jim felt pretty cheap and ignorant, and wished we hadn't been quite so chipper. I couldn't say nothing, and Jim he couldn't for a while, then he says. Well, Den, I reckon it's all right, because if they didn't know, they ain't no use for po' ignorant folks like us to be trying to know, and so, if it's our duty, we got to go and tackle it and do the best we can. Same time, I feel as sorry for dem Paynims as Mars Tom. De hard part gwine to be to kill folks dat a body hain't been acquainted wid and dat hain't done him no harm. Dat's it, you see. If we was to go amongst em, jist we three, and say we's hungry, and asked em for a bite to eat, why, maybe dey's jist like y'other people. Don't you reckon dey is? Why, dey'd give it, I know dey would, and den. Then what? Well, Mars Tom, my idea is like dis. It ain't no use, we can't kill dem post-strangers dat ain't doing us no harm, till we've had practice. I knows it perfectly well, Mars Tom deed I knows it perfectly well. But if we takes a axe or two, jist you and me and Huck, and slips across de river tonight arter de moon's gone down, and kills dat sick family dat's over on the Sny, and burns de house down, and... Oh, you make me tired. Says Tom. I don't want to argue any more with people like you and Huck Finn, that's always wandering from the subject, and ain't got any more sense than to try to reason out a thing that's pure theology by the laws that protect real estate. Now that's just where Tom Sawyer warn't fair. Jim didn't mean no harm, and I didn't mean no harm. We knowed well enough that he was right and we was wrong, and all we was after was to get at the how of it, and that was all, and the only reason he couldn't explain it so we could understand it was because we was ignorant, yes, and pretty dull, too, I ain't denying that, but, land. That ain't no crime, I should think. But he wouldn't hear no more about it, just said if we had tackled the thing in the proper spirit, he would a raised a couple of thousand knights and put them in steel armor from head to heel, and made me a lieutenant and Jim a sutler, and took the command himself and brushed the whole Paynim outfit into the sea like flies and come back across the world in a glory like sunset. But he said we didn't know enough to take the chance when we had it, and he wouldn't ever offer it again. And he didn't. When he once got set, you couldn't budge him. But I didn't care much. I am peaceable, and don't get up rows with people that ain't doing nothing to me. I allowed if the Paynim was satisfied I was, and we would let it stand at that. Now Tommy got all that notion out of Walter Scott's book, which he was always reading. And it was a wild notion, because in my opinion he never could have raised the men, and if he did, as like as not he would have got licked. I took the book and read all about it, and as near as I could make it out, most of the folks that shook farming to go crusading had a mighty rocky time of it. Chapter 2. The Balloon Ascension. Well, Tom got up one thing after another, but they all had tender spots about him somewheres, and he had to shove them aside. So at last he was about in despair. Then the St. Louis papers begun to talk a good deal about the balloon that was going to sail to Europe, and Tom sort of thought he wanted to go down and see what it looked like, but couldn't make up his mind. But the papers went on talking, and so he allowed that maybe if he didn't go he might never have another chance to see a balloon, and next, he found out that Nat Parsons was going down to see it, and that decided him, of course. He wasn't going to have Nat Parsons coming back bragging about seeing the balloon, and him having to listen to it and keep quiet. So he wanted me and Jim to go too, and we went. It was a noble big balloon, and had wings and fans and all sorts of things, and wasn't like any balloon you see in pictures. It was away out toward the edge of town, in a vacant lot, corner of 12th Street, and there was a big crowd around it, and making fun of the man, alien pale feller with that soft kind of moonlight in his eyes, you know, and they kept saying it wouldn't go. It made him hot to hear them, and he would turn on them and shake his fist and say they was animals and blind, but someday they would find they had stood face to face with one of the men that lifts up nations and makes civilizations, and was too dull to know it. And right here on this spot their own children and grandchildren would build a monument to him that would outlast 1,000 years, but his name would outlast the monument. And then the crowd would burst out in a laugh again, and yell at him, and ask him what was his name before he was married, and what he would take to not do it, and what was his sister's cat's grandmother's name, and all the things that a crowd says when they've got hold of a feller that they see they can plague. Well, some things they said was funny, yes, and mighty witty too, I ain't denying that. But all the same it warn't fair nor brave, all them people pitching on one, and they so glib and sharp, and him without any gift of talk to answer back with. But, good land. What did he want to sass back for? You see, it couldn't do him no good, and it was just nuts for them. They had him, you know. But that was his way. I reckon he couldn't help it, he was made so, I judge. He was a good enough sort of creeter, and hadn't no harm in him, and was just a genius, as the paper said, which wasn't his fault. We can't all be sound, we've got to be the way we are made. As near as I can make out, geniuses think they know it all, and so they won't take people's advice, but always go their own way, which makes everybody forsake them and despise them, and that is perfectly natural. If they was humbler, and listened and tried to learn, it would be better for them. The part the professor was in was like a boat, and was big and roomy, and had watertight lockers around the inside to keep all sorts of things in, and a body could sit on them, and make beds on them, too. We went aboard, and there was 20 people there, snooping around and examining, and old Nat Parsons was there, too. The professor kept fussing around getting ready, and the people went ashore, drifting out one at a time, and old Nat he was the last. Of course it wouldn't do to let him go out behind us. We mustn't budge till he was gone, so we could be last ourselves. But he was gone now, so it was time for us to follow. I heard a big shout, and turned around the city was dropping from under us like a shot. It made me sick all through, I was so scared. Jim turned gray and couldn't say a word, and Tom didn't say nothing, but looked excited. The city went on dropping down, and down, and down, but we didn't seem to be doing nothing but just hang in the air and stand still. The houses got smaller and smaller, and the city pulled itself together, closer and closer, and the men and wagons got to looking like ants and bugs crawling around, and the streets like threads and cracks, and then it all kind of melted together. And there wasn't any city anymore, it was only a big scar on the earth, and it seemed to me a body could see up the river and down the river about 1,000 miles, though of course it wasn't so much. By and by the earth was a ball, just a round ball, of a dull color, with shiny stripes wriggling and winding around over it, which was rivers. The Widder Douglas always told me the earth was round like a ball, but I never took any stock in a lot of them superstitions of hers, and of course I paid no attention to that one, because I could see myself that the world was the shape of a plate, and flat. I used to go up on the hill, and take a look around and prove it for myself, because I reckon the best way to get a sure thing on a fact is to go and examine for yourself, and not take anybody's say-so. But I had to give in now that the widder was right. That is, she was right as to the rest of the world, but she weren't right about the part our village is in, that part is the shape of a plate, and flat, I take my oath. The professor had been quiet all this time, as if he was asleep, But he broke loose now, and he was mighty bitter. He says something like this. Idiots. They said it wouldn't go, and they wanted to examine it, and spy around and get the secret of it out of me. But I beat them. Nobody knows the secret but me. Nobody knows what makes it move but me, and it's a new power, and 1,000 times the strongest in the earth. Steam's foolishness to it. They said I couldn't go to Europe. To Europe? Why, there's power aboard to last 5 years, and feed for 3 months. They are fools. What do they know about it? Yes, and they said my airship was flimsy. Why, she's good for 50 years. I can sail the skies all my life if I want to, and steer where I please, though they laughed at that, and said I couldn't. Couldn't steer. Come here, boy, we'll see. You press these buttons as I tell you. He made Tom steer the ship all about and every which way, and learned him the whole thing in nearly no time, and Tom said it was perfectly easy. He made him fetch the ship down most of the earth, and had him spin her along so close to the Illinois prairies that a body could talk to the farmers, and hear everything they said perfectly plain, and he flung out printed bills to them that told about the balloon, and said it was going to Europe. Tom got so he could steer straight for a tree till he got nearly to it, and then dart up and skin right along over the top of it. Yes, and he showed Tom how to land her, and he done it first rate, too, and set her down in the prairies as soft as wool. But the minute we started to skip out the professor says, no, you don't. And shot her up in the air again. It was awful. I begun to beg, and so did Jim, but it only give his temper a rise, and he begun to rage around and look wild out of his eyes, and I was scared of him. Well, then he got on to his troubles again, and mourned and grumbled about the way he was treated, and couldn't seem to get over it, and especially people saying his ship was flimsy. He scoffed at that, and at their saying she weren't simple and would be always getting out of order. Get out of order. That graveled him, he said that she couldn't any more get out of order than the solar sister. He got worse and worse, and I never see a person take on so. It give me the cold shivers to see him, and so it did Jim. By and by he got to yelling and screaming, and then he swore the world should never have his secret at all now, it had treated him so mean. He said he would sail his balloon around the globe just to show what he could do, and then he would sink it in the sea, and sink us all along with it, too. Well, it was the awfulest fix to be in, and here was night coming on. He gave us something to eat, and made us go to the other end of the boat, and he laid down on a locker, where he could boss all the works, and put his old pepper box revolver under his head, and said if anybody come fooling around there trying to land her, he would kill him. We sat scrunched up together, and thought considerable, but didn't say much, only just a word once in a while when a body had to say something or bust, we was so scared and worried. The night dragged along slow and lonesome. We was pretty low down, and the moonshine made everything soft and pretty, and the farmhouses looked snug and homeful, and we could hear the farm sounds, and wished we could be down there, but, laws. We just slipped along over them like a ghost, and never left a track. Away in the night, when all the sounds was late sounds, and the air had a late feel, and a late smell, to about a 2 o'clock feel, as near as I could make out Tom said the professor was so quiet this time he must be asleep, and we'd better. Better what? I says in a whisper, and feeling sick all over, because I knowed what he was thinking about. Better slip back there and tie him, and land the ship, he says. I says, no, sir. Don't you budge, Tom Sawyer. And Jim, well, Jim was kinda gasping, he was so scared. He says. Oh, Mars Tom, don't. F you teshes him, we's gone show. I ain't gwine near him, not for nothing in dis world. Mars Tom, he's plumb crazy. Tom whispers and says that's why we've got to do